irony of the situation is you can go on public land to ski, you can go on public lands to cut wood, you can go on public lands to strip a mountain and leave a cyanide pool, but you cannot go on public lands to pray for the earth and its continued fertility.
Welcome to Sacred Land Speaks, where we dig into the audio archives of the Sacred Land Film Project and revisit the interview clips we left on the cutting room floor over 40 years of filmmaking. I'm your host, Toby McLeod. Today we're going back to 1997, when I sat down with Vine Deloria Jr. for a rare interview with this legendary Standing Rock Sioux author and activist. The first time I asked Vine Deloria for an interview, he said no. I approached him in 1992 in Tucson, Arizona, after his keynote speech at a conference on endangered Native American holy sites, and I asked him for a film interview, but Vine said he really didn't do interviews. Years later, when I was working on the documentary film In the Light of Reverence, which tells the story of three Native American communities fighting to protect their sacred sites, one of the stories centered on protecting Devil's Tower in Wyoming, which is sacred to many tribes, including the Lakota. The Mountain States Legal Foundation and a group of rock climbers had sued the National Park Service for asking climbers to voluntarily refrain from climbing during the month of June out of respect for Native American ceremonies held around the summer solstice. While I was discussing that film with one advisor, Walter Echohawk at the Native American Rights Fund, he called Vine on the phone and said, "You've got to talk to these guys." And Vine agreed to do an interview because he really cared a lot about that issue at Devil's Tower. I did a lot of preparation beforehand and was relieved when we showed up at Vine's house because he was so welcoming and quite casual, puffing on a cigarette throughout the interview and occasionally talking to his dog, Bob, who you'll hear barking in the background. I started by asking Vine why the Black Hills are so significant.
I've been trying to get into all the really old legends to find out exactly what happened there. And it seems to be revealed by spirits and experience as kind of the focal point of our existence. So you can even go back to where the tribe was migrating around the continent. And no matter where they were, they're always, in the end, headed for Bear Butte and the Black Hills. And the people at Rosebud now are able to demonstrate that through archaeoastronomy and discussion of Sioux constellations. One of the constellations, if you go out in the evening, you look up, probably take up a third of the visible sky that you have, and it's a form of a heart. And it then becomes, in our experience, the heart of this continent. And people get kind of turned away because Black Elk was talking about Pike's Peak as the center of the world. And he had this vision of different camp circles. In terms of all the Indian groups, that would probably be true. But each of those groups then has some central location that helps define them. And this goes so far back that there's stories that when we lived near the Gulf of Mexico, they had this vision that we were supposed to migrate west. And people had a visual view from the vision of what these hills looked like, but they didn't know where they were. They migrated up and down into Pennsylvania and around, and finally came back into the Black Hills. So that's been the central focus of ceremonial religious life for a long time. And not in the sense of, Jesus being crucified in Nazareth or whatever, but if you look at the larger cosmos, why, almost any place you designate can be the center of the earth, center of the universe. And we believe that we're on the edge of the Milky Way, which is a small galaxy someplace. We could well be on the edge, or we could well be in the center and everything revolving around us. So a lot of the purpose in ceremonies was to kind of recapitulate, reconstitute universal powers in one location. And that's why in the pipe ceremony you pointed all those directions to bring those powers in and focus them. And what you're doing is establishing a relationship. So you have to do that in practical life, not just in religious life. So the Black Hills became the focus of the migrations, the buffalo hunting, all of those things. Black Hills themselves were very sacred in the sense that permanent occupancy was set aside for the birds and animals. That was their place to be. And that's why they have these runs today around the Black Hills to honor the birds and animals. People would go in there, but they wouldn't stay very long. And so you'd just go into the Black Hills to get lodge poles, or maybe someone would do a vision quest or something on the edge of the Black Hills. But you weren't supposed to stay in there. Part of that was that was one of the major places the buffalo emerged in the springtime. And there are all kinds of places along the Missouri. They used to have these caves they would come out of. Wind Cave and Buffalo Gap were the major places. So you didn't want to irritate any of the animals. So it's not like we designated a place and said, this is going to be sacred. See? It came out of a lot of experience. And the idea is not to pretend to own it, or not to exploit it, but to respect it. And trying to get people to see it, that's a dimension of religion. It's really difficult.
Devil's Tower is a dramatic rock formation that juts up out of the forest that surrounds it in northwest Wyoming on the edge of the Black Hills. It's made of columns of igneous rock that abruptly end in a plateau 867 feet up in the air. It's significant for over two dozen tribes in the northern plains, and there are many sacred narratives surrounding the origin of the giant monolith. Many of those stories involve a bear chasing a group of girls who are saved by offering a prayer and finding safety on a large rock as it rises out of the ground, and the bear scrapes the sides with his claws as he tries to reach them. Hence the Lakota name, Matotipila, Lodge of the Bear.
The Devil's Tower stories are very historical, and I've been doing a lot of work. I'm trying to dig up exactly how it was formed. I'm convinced that the stories about the bear chasing the girls, some variant of a bear with one of those Indian communities occurred there. Because you go, and you'll be filming this, you see the top part of the Devil's Tower, badly eroded rock, and then you got pretty clean rock underneath. And it's down in a valley. And so the idea of a stream eroding all that down, it's ridiculous, because if you go look, the Devil's Tower and the bowl it's in are still below the ground, 10 miles away. So I think it's one of the very ancient landmarks in North America. There are all kinds of others. The Hopi seem to have squatted on one of the mesas that really has power. And Six Nations have very good power spots in some of those lakes. And a pipestone quarry. Navajo Mountain, which is Four Corners, are sacred to all kinds of people. So you have to ask, you know, if this is sacred to several groups of people, doesn't it have more spiritual power? And aren't there more spirits there than there are in any of these other places which are sacred to only one tribe? And so then you begin to intuit that the place was one of those sanctuaries where people could come and go without fighting each other, and had to do that. Couldn't fight your way to the Devil's Tower and hold a religious ceremony. The same way with the pipestone. So what what the Sioux and Cheyenne would do, would have a ceremonial year that was supposed to end up in that vicinity. And the Rosebud people have identified the three mountains that are part of the ceremony. So in the spring, people would be following the buffalo herd, and they'd have to do a series of four ceremonies, the last one of which would end up either at Devil's Tower or Bear Butte, depending on what year it was and what the situation was. So this is written down now in a book on star knowledge, and Devil's Tower is in Yankaha, which is about 40 miles south. Those, I think, are the horns of the buffalo, and then the Bear's Butte that becomes the nose, and you have these complicated ceremonies have to be done there. And that's for continued renewal of the earth and life. And the buffalo, of course, symbolizing Mother Earth and symbolizing life. So those are very important. That's the way you didn't hunt out the buffalo herds. That you took just enough to ensure the buffalo continued, but you had to do the ceremony thanking them and thanking all the other spirits. So then there are other ceremonies for the rest of the year. So your year is kind of under ideal conditions, broken up into migrations where you have to be at a certain location to do a certain ceremony. And that keeps everything balanced. So you come to the place, and it does send a chill up your spine, whether you're Indian or Anglo or whatever. I mean, it's an extremely impressive place. And I would imagine even some of the climbers get a tremendous emotional jolt with that thing. But here comes the basic question of respect. See, if you really respect something, I mean, you don't go start putting up Kool-Aid stands on the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. You know, and humans, particularly industrial society, has no sense of self-discipline. They allow themselves to do anything in the world. And the Indian thing was, if you don't really totally understand it, you better kind of, you know, not make the total commitment to the thing. You better leave it as partially mysterious. And I think a lot of people don't understand that it's not that Indians should have exclusive rights there. It's that that location is sacred enough, it should have time of its own. And that once it has time of its own, then the people who know how to do ceremonies should come and minister to it. See, and that's so hard to get across to people.
This idea that a sacred place would need time of its own is so profound. It shook me out of the Western sense that religion is about people who practice it, and helped me understand that an indigenous sense of spirituality is about relationship to place, respect for place, community responsibility to place as kin, as a relation. Vine points out how these different worldviews and spiritual conflicts lead to the battles over the land. Native Americans tried five times in the 1980s to use the American legal system and the American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978 to try to protect their sacred sites, but they failed in all five lawsuits because they couldn't get the courts to understand and respect place-based religions. So there was a lot riding on the Devil's Tower lawsuit.
Devil's Tower seems to be the point of confrontation between, I think, religious and secular forces. And it comes from the government's policy of multiple use. We want as many people as possible to use a certain thing. They don't do this for the Christian religion. They allow them exclusive use of all kinds of things. See, they don't really believe that the Indian religion's a religion, so they figure it's a multiple use. Irony of the situation is that you can go on public land to ski, you can go on public lands to cut wood, you can go on public lands to strip a mountain and leave a cyanide pool, but you cannot go on public lands to pray for the earth and its continued fertility. Almost everything involving land involves great controversy, and the question then becomes, can any religious group, Indian or otherwise, limit the power of the federal government? Since the federal government has no discipline itself, Any question the court's returned is no, you can't. So then you move to the next step, accommodation. Can you force them to accommodate? And that's really what we're doing with the Devil's Tower case. Not asking, not expecting exclusive use, but trying to get the rules to accommodate. And at that point, you get the question arises, you know, what is it that we're accommodating? See? And here, your difference in religion is tremendous, because if you go up to Red Rocks for the Easter sunrise service, the situation is holy for the period of the service. And people leave, and it becomes a rock concert place. And what Indians are saying, no, the thing has value in itself. You ought to be protected, whether there are people there or not. That's going to be a really tough one, because you need a whole intellectual framework behind that in order for your evidence to make sense.
On the advice of Native American elders, the National Park Service made the June climbing restriction at Devil's Tower voluntary. I asked Vine to help me understand this approach.
If you force people to do the mechanical thing, you haven't accomplished anything. But you get to somehow bring them along to say, yeah, I do respect that. And I, because I'm a person with integrity, will not violate the thing. So the voluntary thing, having legal training, I'd sue the sons of bitches and close down all the Christian places in the national park. But the elders are a little more calm than I am. They say, well, you know, maybe if we get people to voluntarily not do it, then they'll begin to accumulate respect, and then they'll treat it differently and turn the situation around.
But some of the climbers didn't respect the climbing ban or the tribe's responsibility to Devil's Tower.
Well, it's kind of like the problem we have with people, white men raising buffalo, see? I'm all for it, and I support the buffalo raising. But they treat them like cattle instead of like people. See, and if you'd, when you harvest your crop, if you'd have a medicine man come out and tell the buffalo, look, this is the only way we can stay alive, and this is the only way we can help your people expand and have a happy life. So we're going to have to kill some of you. And they used to do those kind of things so that they wouldn't have to deal with the retaliation, because those things can retaliate, and it's in the literature. You know, different spirits can come back on you. So what we need to do with the Devil's Tower is show the people that you get to pull in a bit and allow the place to, first, I think, have a period of calm, but second, you know, enable people to find the right way to communicate with it. And a climber comes in, and all he wants to do is look at which place to go up. They're hammering all these pitons in. And the question is, you know, I'm all in favor of climbing. I mean, it's a good way to test yourself. I imagine for many a form of religious experience. But the question is, can you limit yourself to certain things and respect other things? I think the guy is the complainant is just, you know, filing this thing on behalf of these right-wing nuts in Mountain States Legal. But there's so many climbers that have agreed voluntarily, we won't do this, see, that you look at the few remaining. I think last year there was one of them in that we're a commercial climber and a company and we're losing money and all that. Well, so what? All kinds of people lose money because the government takes certain locations and allows the general public or allows no one to. I mean, my God, I'm losing money because I'm not allowed to graze cattle on Area 51. So what? That happens. I see the complainants in this case are, I think, just stirring the thing up. I think majority of climbers have cooperated and will. You can climb anywhere. You don't necessarily have to climb the Devil's Tower. And they all climb Yosemite and all these other places anyway. So the question is, does the property right of an individual citizen mean that they can go on any federal land anytime they want for any purpose whatsoever? And it's been ruled in many cases, no. And that's what we're asking now.
I was surprised when Vine told me that he didn't have major issues with private landowners.
I think you could make accommodations with most people. If you go into court and sue some landowner and say, we've got to use your land to do this and that, you're going to have a terrible time. You're going to send a delegation and, you know, make it a ceremonial meeting with them and talk to them and say, well, here, we really need this. I think most people would accommodate themselves. And that's what happened for a century. People just accommodated those things. They'd say, yeah, don't leave the gate open so the cattle will leave. And people could use those sites. Then when you formalize it and put it in a bureaucratic directive, everybody's up the wall against property rights and all of this. And, you know, de Tocqueville said that 150 years ago. Americans believe litigation is the only way to resolve questions, all questions. So I don't see there's any problem really with private landowners. But you can't walk in and say, we're going to do this or that. I mean, you have to treat them like people and explain the situation.
Our conversation eventually turned from the non-native people who disrespect the tribe's spiritual practices to those who try to co-opt the spiritual experience for themselves.
In the first place, you want to keep ceremonies secret just for Indians. Then you turn around, all kinds of Indians are inviting non-Indians in the ceremonies. What are we doing here? And then you see that most of them, 99%, get a really good experience, and a lot of those become better people. So everybody's happy. But they don't really get to any depth where they'd be useful as spiritual leaders, and they have no communities to return to. And you can hang around Indians for a while, but it gets kind of boring because most of the things Indians do are secular things. So it's a big dilemma. At the start of the New Age, I was kind of irritated like the rest of the people. And the more I looked at it, I thought, well, if they're not expending their energy that way, they might be doing something really dangerous. We had a meeting on Indian religion at Harvard Divinity School. And one of the religious leaders opened the conference with a prayer and a pipe. We just passed the pipe around. And after that, there must have been a dozen whites came up to me just breathless. I said, I've never been in a ceremony like that. That meant so much to me. I just can't tell you how I love Indian religion. And a momentary experience, and I mean, no different than me lighting a cigarette, actually, in terms of what they understood was going on. I mean, the craving is just, so there's a desperate need to appropriate from somebody, not necessarily Indians, but from somebody, some feeling, emotional feeling of authenticity. And the problem is that they all think of themselves as individualists. They don't have definable communities to return to. So they're just trapped. And I really feel sorry for them.
Vine said it gets tricky when you try to garner support for sacred site struggles from these same people who are looking to fill a spiritual void in their lives.
It's a big dilemma. You need a big constituency in the majority to help you protect the sacred sites. But you have to talk about the sacred sites in order to convince people this is a worthy cause. I know I used to have quite a bit of conversations with Bill Tallball and the Medicine Wheel people on how you protect this. And he said, I'm just baffled because we get all kinds of allies among the whites and we make some progress. And then they all want to go out to that sacred site and experience it. And he said, here, you've asked them to help. You've told them it's real, that this is very necessary. And then you've got to turn around and say, well, we don't want you to go out there because we have to have solitude to do these things. We're not doing these ceremonies on a stage. And so it's just a utterly rock and a hard place there. And then you have the fact that almost everyone has to work today, so you can't always take off for ceremonies. And when certain ceremonies do, you go to your boss and say, I need 10 days because I have to supervise this or that. You don't have a job very soon. I think in addition to simply there being more people, there are more pressures as people interact. I mean, almost impossible to get through those pressures and still preserve the sacred place. And then you have Indians themselves doing runs and rides and all this, which is their way of symbolically expressing to the majority the validity of the issue. But it doesn't have any, it doesn't do any good to have hundreds of Indians running around trying to do the same ceremony. So you just look at it. Population growth alone forces you to change many things. I think designating sacred sites as national historic sites is a stopgap measure which really offers no protection in the end. If people know too much about it, then they swarm all over there with their video cameras and, you know, leave their picnic mess. Some years ago, South Dakota Highway Department asked me if I would identify all the sacred sites to the Sioux in South Dakota, and I said, of course not. It's better to have them undisturbed and unused than to have all these people tromping, you know, busloads of Japanese tourists going through. And they were quite put off because they wanted them as tourist attractions. So if you designate some of these things National Historic Sites, they'd just be run to death, you know. The ones that are already well known and you want to protect, I think that's a live option. But it's to identify new ones and have them designated, I'd be very leery. I'm inclined to think right now, if you could get a recognition that certain sites are sacred and should be left in isolation. Bill was telling me one time about, he was trying to help Park Service identify things. He says, we're coming down this valley and I see these piles of rocks. And I said, we better not go any further. And they said, oh no, this is a cairn of some kind or whatever. And he said, no. This is when they old-timers found a valley that had bad spirits in it. They would put these rocks every so often so people coming could see that that was a marker, don't go in that area. He said, we just left it alone. And same way with Yellowstone, you know, it's left that alone. Because I think if you went back 2,000 or 3,000 years, you had smokes and stuff coming out of the ground every place, I mean, geysers and God knows what. So they argued with him. He said, well, I'll prove it to you. He said, we'll go about a mile and a half over here and then make a little fish hook, and there'll be another one just like this. And they did. And he said, I could not convince them that my interpretation was right. And all these scholars said, oh, no. So Bill said, well, you go in that valley and dig if you want. I'm not going to. And there are even some places Indians left alone. Go to the edge of it. So somehow, if you could get that across to people, but some of this stuff gets so subtle because there's such a crying need for emotional experience. And yet the emotional experience put in an intellectual context that don't make any sense and doesn't interpret what the experience was. People would have to come to realize that many things exist for themselves. They have an integrity under themselves. And that the attitude of our species is that this whole thing was created for us. It has no value except how we use it. And if you get people to realize we really are part of a finite world, we're part of a cosmos, the resources are going out, and the Earth itself had characteristics. I don't see how people can look and they say a lot of iron's up in Mesabi and there's a lot of copper in this other place and there's a lot of oil in Texas and Oklahoma. Those are physical concentrations of mechanical power. How they can't see that there are spiritual concentrations of spiritual power, non-mechanical, relational, and it does should be left alone. You can dig all the oil you want, but you can't touch this other thing.
Vine was the son of an Episcopal minister, and before becoming a lawyer and an author, he set out to be a religious leader like his father, and he earned a theology degree in 1963. He generously tried to help me understand indigenous cosmology in contrast to Western religions.
Well, the central problem is that Western religion, basically materialistic, And I think that's because of the Western tradition that God works in history, which is to say in events, but not in people and places. So what you end up with then is the capability of establishing a church or shrine any place that's convenient to people. Let's treat Earth as an object, and Indians don't believe it's an object. And they base that on thousands of years of experience. And in a way, you get irritated with non-Indians. But another way, you know, they were reconciled to European land, then Christianity came in and destroyed all their shrines, did all kinds of detrimental things to them. Unfortunately, they were under Christianity so long that when they came over here, they did that to Indian shrines. And the idea being that there is nothing spiritual. Everything is material. You find that just promulgated throughout science. So even in the social sciences, people don't stop and think that the best things we experience and the best things we know are immaterial things. They're ideas or emotions. Religion and science in the West are both wholly materialistic. And consequently, when you then try and tell them, well, if you look at the Earth, there are certain places that seem to have power, and we don't know what kind of power it is, except you have a different feeling, you feel energized. And the question then for ceremonials is, how do you approach that? Take something that's larger in yourself and create a vehicle whereby you can be in communion with it. And I think the various tribes located these various places. And it's difficult to tell some of the younger generation, these aren't perfect circles, say, and these aren't perfect triangles or whatever, that frequently you can have an area that has two or three mountains within, say, 50 miles of each other, which are sacred to different tribes. And they're sacred not because they designate them that, but because they've experienced that. And the ceremonies then come out of their experience, not out of a philosophical search to explain things. So if you talk to a good medicine man, they'll say, well, I have different spirits that help me do this and that, but I really, at the bottom, don't understand the whole thing. I just know it works. And so Indians had this, I think, you know, tremendous respect for whatever powers existed in the universe. And they conceived those as personal powers. Power had personality. And if you go to the West, they're telling you this little microbe in a soup of chemicals got hit by lightning and it evolved into Newt Gingrich. See? And you have to ask the question, how can matter produce personality and intelligence? Because those are entirely different things. You have cause and effect in science. Well, if you go over to the personal aspect of things, in communications, you have either communications or non-communication. Non-communication is frequently as good and as powerful a solution to a problem as communication. So what you're talking about is a relationship. So I think that this locations were discovered to be sacred, and it probably took a long time, probably thousands of years, to sort out how you approach those. And that's why a lot of the ceremonies are you simply go out into the land at a certain place under supervision of a medicine man and open yourself up. And what I think is powerful about these religions, you can continue to have revelations. So all the revelation is telling you is how you and your community at this time in life can adjust to the rest of the world. And so it's not any information you bring back for that ceremony. You're not supposed to run all over the country and say, you believe this and you're saved, see? So it ends up quite a different situation. And unfortunately, the objective teaching of both Western religion and Western politics has convinced people to put in the front of their minds all these beliefs. And yet they do have experiences similar to what Indians have. I think all people have all kinds of experience. So there's no intellectual framework to put that in. And so people, you know, particularly today, they look back at a mythical time when all the Pilgrim Fathers went to church, Norman Rockwell and the whole thing. And they get terribly upset when any group appears to believe something different. And so I think we're the most visible group that the backlash can hit. And being materialists, they couldn't believe there's anything sacred about the Black Hills or Devil's Tower or anything.
I'm often struck by the aggressiveness of Western religions in contrast to the humility of Native practitioners. Vine describes this deep indigenous understanding that a person finds his or her humanity through their relationship to other beings and with the earth. It's kinship, really. All my relations. Matakwiasi, as the Lakota say.
No single person can begin to comprehend the spiritual world. And we go on the assumption that, through experience, that the world we see is not the only world we have to deal with, that there are spirits in different places. All the spirits have personalities. They have intelligence, but not total intelligence. It's simply a different kind of existence. Some may be dead spirits, some may be spirits of the future, but our world is interspliced with other worlds who have different ways of expressing themselves. That being the case, for a small community, you can't allow the situation to be that one or two people have the ability to communicate with larger and smaller worlds. And the spirits can't communicate with just one person. There's a limit to what we can understand or experience. So in your average Indian community, pre-contact, you'd have a whole series of people. All for a community of, say, 600-700, you might have many as a dozen people. And they would each know a little bit about them. The ceremony would be delivered to them. They'd be able to perform it. And the cumulative effect of having all these people there is you keep the community balanced with respect to the rest of the universe. And you try and determine what is the historical sequence going on in these other dimensions. The idea of prophecy is very strong in a lot of tribes. You can get long-term prophecies or very short-term. I don't know of a single tribe that went out on the warpath, so to speak, that didn't first have a medicine man tell them what was going to happen. And a lot of times, I know a story of the Yanktons that they were told if they went down and fought the Pawnees that their seven best men would be killed, not to do this. So then they had a council after the medicine man told them that. And about three of them said, well, we've killed people in our life, and now they say that it's our fate to be killed at this time. If we didn't go, we'd be cowards, and we wouldn't let the people who need to have revenge on us have their day. And that would put everything out of balance. So they went on the war party and got killed. But if you go tribe by tribe, it becomes absolutely fascinating. The number of people who are responsible to keep that community balanced. I lived up in Bellingham, Washington, around the tip of the United States. And, you know, it rains in Washington State 99% of the time. So when I was talking to some of the Lummies, they said they had a rain dance. And I said, boy, you need rain, like Arizona needs sun. And then they explained it to me, that there was one family that knew this song. And in particularly bad snow and rain years, If it starts snowing heavily and the snow started to accumulate, if that snow got over the longhouse door, you had a whole village in big trouble. So you had this family that knew this song, and maybe once in 100 years, it would snow that bad, and the people would come out and they'd sing this song, and the snow would turn back to rain, and the rain would melt the snow, and they'd be all right. Now you see, in one way, that's a wholly secular phenomenon. What you do using is the vibrations of sound and the communication of the song, talk to the spirits that guide the weather, or the spirits that are responsible for you, and getting them to just make an adjustment. A lot of tribes say that, instead of saying religion, they said, this is our way of doing things. And so that was the moral code and the way you conducted ceremonies. But if you look at the ethnological literature, scholars have examined tribes in typical Western individualism. They say, well, this group names somebody, and this group does peace, and this group... They can't see that in that community there's an intermixture, and that the whole thing was religious in the sense that the community knew how to adjust to the world and the spirit because they had so many people doing that on behalf of them. So you go through the United States then, and what you find are those sacred centers. I at first thought those were the sites where they had the first revelation that this was a sacred place. And more inclined, as I listen to more tribal people speak, I'm more inclined to think that they keep getting ceremonies as they migrate or as they live someplace for a long time. And when the whole community is about to really have a gestalt experience, they're somehow led over to that sacred spot, see? And then you'd have a sacred spot as the center of your universe and other sacred locations around that are representative of those subsidiary places. And the whole thing is a big complex. Now, for a lot of the northern plains, you say, well, if this is true and we're accurate, then we can look up and find the constellation in the sky. And what's going on above is the same thing that happens below. It's a teepee and it mirrors itself, see? So the problem then comes is what happens when the community is shattered and you don't have enough people to keep those adjustments going. And you lose that sacred spot. What you end up with is several sacred spots which are still sacred, but they're supposed to be connected to a whole. And if you go to the medicine wheel, it isn't just that wheel. It's the area for about 20 miles around that has little shrines and those things. The whole complex is sacred, see? And the only comparable thing in white society, you know, would be cemeteries or Monticello or some battlefield or whatever. And you understand them very quickly. They're places where secular historical things happen. They were important to people. They didn't want to forget them. They wanted to commemorate them, which is fine. But see, it's kind of a process inside yourself. You don't get the spirits to cooperate with you. So I think, you know, we're under the gun. The secularization process is just going to continue till everybody's flat. A lot of tribes say that you got to stand up for these principles till the very end, regardless. Because a lot of them expect a cleansing. They look at the floods this winter and say, you know, things keep getting out of balance.
Once we completed In the Light of Reverence, Vine generously participated in question and answer sessions following community and film festival screenings. At the Telluride Mountain Film Festival in 2001, we could hear rock climbers at the back of the theater hissing at the film in disapproval. As Vine and I sat on stage after the film, one climber rose to confront Vine in the Q&A session.
Yeah, I kind of take issue with the point that you have to have a community in order to have either rights or a sense of responsibility. Why can't an individual let's say, go climb Devil's Tower and have a sense of responsibility to where respecting where he is, respecting the spiritual value of that natural asset, enjoying the beauty of it, not thinking just recreational entertainment, but thinking spiritual value from it, and feeling a sense of responsibility even to give back or to be reverent in that place. Who's to say that one has to have a community in order to be able to have the right to be there or to use it in a way that's responsive?
So you use responsible about three different ways in one sentence, right?
Well, I think there are many ways to be responsible. That's my point.
Well, now, what kind of behavior would you call responsible? You're climbing up and down Devil's Tower, and you're saying I'm being responsible. Who are you being responsible to?
If I don't chip the mountain up and light fires and throw rocks off the top, I think I'd be responsible for the environment that I'm in.
So what is it that you're going to do at Devil's Tower that you don't do anything else?
I'm going to go up it, take personal satisfaction, spiritual satisfaction from that personal achievement, and leave.
Yeah, I could get personal satisfaction for robbing banks, but that wouldn't necessarily be right. What I'm trying to get you to see is that you're part of a community. You should be part of a community.
I'm not part of a community that's chosen to exclude me from that desire of mine to be there. I'm part of a community of climbers that want to climb, but why do I even have to be part of a community of climbers to be able to climb?
Well, you can climb all you want. What I was trying to do is get you to see the underlying real spiritual thing, and not just the goody-goody feeling. But I just don't see how.
I think it's a discussion about what's really spiritual.
All right, well.
And my point is, I don't think it necessarily has to be a community to define spirituality or the exercise of spirituality.
Well, I don't know what you do if you're not a mystic, then.
What's wrong with being a mystic? I'm not a mystic, but what's wrong with being a mystic?
Well, nothing. I think a mystic, the individual isolates themselves from a community or society and goes through rigorous exercises. I'm sure they have some spiritual experience in some depth. And in kind of the loss, understand what you think is spiritual, that you can go around and do basically anything you want, and you have a good feeling, and you're at the same time being responsible. I mean, what you're being responsible to? I don't understand you at all. I interpret what you're telling me. You go and do things, and you're not a lawbreaker, and in that sense, you're responsible. And sure, that's fine. But
I think going in and shooting a petroglyph is a very different thing from going in a place that someone else wants to preserve for exclusively for their culture. I think it's there for everyone to use in their own way, providing they're responsible the way they use it. I think it's there for everyone. I don't think any one culture or any one person owns nature or owns the place.
No, I didn't agree to be there, but if you look beyond the Indian community and you see what non-Indian communities do with nature, you hardly have a basis for an argument.
Unfortunately, 34 years after we sat down for this interview, people are still having these arguments. But since Vine died in 2005, we don't have him to help us understand these complex issues and how we might resolve them. Tune into the next episode of Sacred Land Speaks for part two of my interview with Vine DeLoria Jr., where he breaks down national policy in relation to Native people, discusses his cultural identity, and makes predictions about the future of technology. If you like what you've heard, please rate and subscribe to Sacred Land Speaks on your favorite podcast app. You can also visit sacredland.org to learn more about our films, resources, and suggested actions you can take to protect sacred places. This episode was produced and written by Callie Shanafelt-Wong and Toby McLeod. Our film interview with Vine was recorded by Will Perinello and Andy Black, along with co-producers Melinda Maynor-Lowry and Jessica Abbey. Our theme music was composed and performed by Stefan Smith and Charles Johnson. Sacred Land Speaks is brought to you by the Sacred Land Film Project of Earth Island Institute, based in the Lejeune Ohlone Territory of Huchiun, otherwise known as Berkeley, California. Thanks for joining us.